Dear Nicholas, Umaya, and Shibli, thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview for the Thinking and Working Politically Community of Practice. I am so thrilled to have this opportunity to speak with the three of you. But let me start perhaps with a brief round of introductions for the benefit of our audience. So we have Dr. Nicola Nixon, who is the Senior Director of Governance at the Asia Foundation, or TAF, and as part of her role, she oversees the foundation's governance portfolio across 17 offices in Asia. Nicola has over 20 years of experience in international development, and she has worked for organizations including the Australian Department for Foreign Affairs and Trade and the UNDP. And I should also say that she is a fabulous member of the steering committee of the Thinking, Working, Politically, Community of Practice. So thank you, Nicola, for joining us. Next, we have Sumaya Saluja, who is program manager for the Asia Foundation's regional governance team. And as part of her role, she works to support her team in incorporating and learning from politically smart approaches in TAF's governance programming. Over the past decade, Sumaya has led programs and policy-directed research on social accountability, urban governance, and the adolescent health in South and Southeast Asia. And last but not least, we have Sadat Shibli, who is director of the Asia Foundation's Bangladesh office. Shibli also has two decades of experience leading governance programs that focus on issues ranging from improving the business climate to countering extremism to promoting decent work and building public-private networks. Among other things, he has played an instrumental role in promoting decent work and acceptable working conditions in the tannery sector in Bangladesh, which we hope to hear more about. So I'm very excited about the guest lineup we have today, because we're going to discuss a paper that TAF has just recently published called On the Right Tack: Reflections on Coalition Building Initiatives Across the Asia Foundation. And I will be asking our guests about what these coalitions look like on the ground, what they have set out to do, and what they have been able to accomplish, and what lessons have emerged from these initiatives, especially from a TWP perspective. So let me start off with Nicola, who is one of the authors of this publication, with a big picture question for you, if I may. Nicola, can you tell us a little bit about the different case studies that are including in this publication?
Sure, Elena. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you on this podcast. So in this publication, we've had a go at documenting and reflecting on six case studies of coalition building activities across the Asia Foundation. And these are they're different. The commonality is that they all bring together different actors, often different actors who wouldn't otherwise engage with one another, or wouldn't have the opportunity to do so, in a goal-oriented way. So it's that they share a goal. It's a goal-oriented coalition intended to achieve a policy reform or an institutional reform of some kind. And we document these studies across the Philippines. The Philippines case study is obviously the most well-known of our coalition building programs. That's the Coalitions for Change program. And there's a lot of publications, there's a lot of evidence and analysis of CFC out there. We include the Coalitions for Change program because they use a very tactical approach to bring together alliances for strategic policy change. But we also document several other studies. So we look at Sri Lanka. In Sri Lanka, we look at an example of where government actors have been brought together to facilitate mid-level government officials. In fact, in one instance, brought together to facilitate institutional reform within local government authorities in Sri Lanka. Then we look at a coalition building activity in the Timor-Leste office that convened private sector actors to build a business coalition. The one in Bangladesh that you'll be talking to Shibli about, that was around the reforms to the tannery sector, building data communities in Nepal through our Data for Developments program, which brings together different data scientists and data science actors There they think of it as sort of a data ecosystems, where you have data scientists, you have civil society organizations, and also government, and ways that you can facilitate coalitions around open government agendas. And then finally, there's one on Thailand, which looks at how the TAF office in Thailand convened a coalition for a very specific education sector reform. And so the aim of the publication is to document what has been identified for a really long time in international development as a central pillar of the sorts of work that we want to be doing in thinking and working politically or doing development differently, etc. But possibly under-analysed. Not saying that we've done a whole ton of analysis on it either. It's a reflection piece. We think of it as a first step in some of our thinking about where we can identify the commonalities, how we can understand the differences, etc., within these coalitions. So we're hoping it contributes to the conversation on how we can improve development practice by thinking about the work that we do a little bit differently.
Wonderful, Nicola. That's a really good framing for this. And I actually very much appreciate what you're saying around the fact that consistently it seems that in this field, a key finding or a key factor that is always identified as being instrumental in bringing about change is this coalition building. And so this will give us a bit of an evidence base really to dissect what has worked well, what has worked less well, and why, and understand the issue of coalition building from a deeper perspective. Can I ask you a follow-up question? In all of these examples that you gave, it sounds that the stakeholders that are involved are obviously government, because you're trying to bring about some policy change, but then also different partners in either civil society or the private sector or both. And I'm wondering, how does TAF come up with the idea of what sectors to work on and what partners to engage with? Is it something that you observe and then say, actually, there's already traction on this issue in this country that we can support? Or do you take a different way of doing this? And perhaps if you can tell us also, how long has TAF been doing this? Because obviously the Coalitions for Change program in the Philippines has been around for a while, but I don't know if this is something that has been going on in TAF for decades, for 10 years. What is it? Thank you so much.
Sure. So we have a whole different range of ways of identifying entry points. And usually these entry points are around where, as you say, there is some kind of momentum that our teams are seeing for change in some area. And I'm sure Shibley will go into this in terms of what they were seeing in the early days on the tannery sector work that they did. Those entry points might be around opportunities that you see on the side of a program that in a particular sector. So we might have a sort of more traditional program going on in a particular sector and the team starts to notice particular opportunities. Or they might relate to the sorts of stakeholder relationships we have with government in particular, where through conversations with government actors, we can see that there's an uptick in interest in a particular reform area. Whether or not then the coalitions then are comprised of different actors, and in some cases, it interests me, particularly where government gets involved in the coalition itself. And in some cases that happens. In other cases, the government is engaged with the coalition and the coalition communicates and operates sort of adjacent to the government and engages and influences them there. But I think this picking up of entry points is where, and what we're sort of codifying as the regional governance team is how teams are thinking and using, they're thinking and working politically, but they're also using political economy analysis to identify some of those entry points where they can see that there's reform happening. In terms of timeframes, I think, you know, our offices have been around forever in most countries. You know, if people throw out 65 years, and I can't tell you all of them, but there's, you know, lots of since the end of World War II. And so in some cases, and there are 10 to 15 year ongoing engagements with particular stakeholders. We're actually just documenting another case study at the moment, which, and you can see through four or five donor programs, different donors over time, but there's this lineage of the same core relationships all the way through, different types of local governance reforms over a more than 10-year period. And so some of those really long ones we think are really interesting stories as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, so I gather, obviously, the Asia Foundation has a sort of a very special privilege in that it has been working in Asia for a very long time, has built relationships along the way, and has been able to commit to this kind of way of supporting change makers in place through coalitions for a long time. So that's really good. Let me now try to get a closer look at the coalitions in the publication in greater depth. And I wonder, Sumaya, if you could give us an example or two of how some of these coalitions have contributed to institutional change or system reform, and what do you think has been a factor or factors that matter in that? Thank you.
Sure, Eileen, and again, thank you so much for having us on this podcast. I think two case studies here come to mind, both that Nicola mentioned, and they will speak to some of the elements that Nicola was highlighting as well. The first one is from Timor-Leste. This too, our engagement began after TAF had already started working with the tourism, with the government on a new policy. But in parallel to that, because it was working with members and businesses in the tourism industry who themselves were thinking of what their role should be in attracting more tourists and generating more revenue. And so this began as a conversation with just two prominent business partners. And they started to think about what their role could be. And they started with the convening of 15 hoteliers in 2017. And then TAF continued, supported from behind in terms of helping them come up with terms of reference, action plans, but truly it was just led with them to try to understand what they could do to A, identify what some of these legal and regulatory environments were, but what other support they could provide. And so one of those examples as this built up was in 2018, where this association of hoteliers from Timor-Leste actually took over all the marketing activities of the Ministry of Tourism, and they were just doing that themselves. And now, currently, there's a new national tourism strategy that the government is developing, and it explicitly recognizes the need to work more closely with associations in the industry and sees the private sector and government working hand in hand to develop this major sector in the country. In terms of your point on what about it may have worked, with this one as particular, and this is not my analysis, but very much something that the team has emphasized when we've spoken to them, is the fact that they didn't focus on the form. Like, they did not start initially by coming in and saying, let's set up a tourism association. This association is going to have this governance structure, and then it's going to set out to do that and then be pushing from behind to sustain momentum. It basically just focused on what is the function. So there was interest among some actors to say, we need to do more. There's a policy, but there needs to be, there's still certain blockages, and there's still things that we who have some capital, even as tourism business owners, what else can we do? And it started with that, and them convening their colleagues, which started with 15 people and now is over 50 and has expanded beyond just hotel owners to restaurant owners and others. And they are part of formal delegations for the government. But it expanded through that as people had interest and made it what they needed to serve the kind of needs and the outcomes they were looking for. So now it is a formal association, so it has a more formal form. But it was very much started in a very informal way, and it was just trying to support people navigate a process where they were trying to just improve tourism and boost the tourism industry Timor-Leste. The second example is similar, and this one is from Sri Lanka. And this is an example, as Nicola was saying, which is over a decade long. So it's been something that TAF has been working on in a space across different programs. It started in 2010, where the Asia Foundation worked with the government, the Sri Lankan government, to support a national policy on local governments. But the coalition part have actually come in later to try to see how this policy can be implemented or you can achieve some of those institutional changes. And one of the reasons why is that anyone who's familiar with Sri Lanka would know that there is quite a contested history when it comes to decentralization reform. And this has been since the mandate in 1987. And so subnational governance really by national parties has never been used as a way to let's actually work on devolution, because it's an important way to improve local governance and achieve more equitable resource allocation. That's just something that political parties at a national level have stayed away from. But because the foundation has been working and was working in this space since 2005, they had built quite a few relationships with local government officials and been able to pilot different initiatives. So they started, and one of these was they established these local governance resource centers in 21 of the 25 districts. And these centers were therefore these dedicated mechanisms where you could work, which were targeting district level local authorities to improve some of the technical aspects of their work. So things around data collection, budget analysis, etc. But they were also a physical space, which also helped as they allowed stakeholders to come in and speak to one another. But because it was set up, what helped was that it was set up within the institution and not as an independent body outside. So it just fell within the provincial government's local government department. So these local governance resource units were set up within the institution, and they were a space where you could work on strengthening the technical aspects of local governance, so things around budget analysis, digital data collection, but they were also a physical space for stakeholders to come in and talk to one another. Now, within each of these resource centers, TAF brought together the technical experts from the civil service. And these were these local resource pool of experts who were taking away data that actually only they have access to within the government, but then using it to bring in different stakeholders to have some of these conversations on challenges that one was facing. So this included senior level bureaucrats like department heads, and mayors, but also you had frontline workers who for the first time were given a space and seat on the table. And just having that institutional clout, I think, for frontline workers made them champions of this process and created momentum. And in this space, you could then have this multi-stakeholder grouping of government actors who could then were interested in solving some of these challenges and improving local governance. But then to enable this system at a local level, TAF worked on creating a loose coalition at a state level. And this was from a group of technical officers. And it was very loose, where they were using online platforms like just WhatsApp to exchange knowledge, information, and meet each other. But as they were doing that, they started to build a collective sense of identity. And in that, one of the things that they were invested in was supporting the local systems and the local resource governance units. And this contributed to creating an ecosystem within a larger institution to support reform at a local level and support local government, but within a larger political backdrop that wasn't particularly incentivized to look at and pay attention to it. So these largely, as our colleague calls it, could be seen as coalitions of influence. They weren't doing much more, but they helped creating that enabling environment. And then lastly was at the third level, where building these coalitions, where the subnational governance program worked with high-level provincial chairpersons and brought them together on this forum. And by bringing them year on year, they were actually can be seen as this bulwark that were holding this constitutional mandate for devolution, and irrespective of changes through election cycles, were invested in promoting that. And this became a formal coalition in 2016 when the national government really pushed forward a good governance agenda. So taking that good governance agenda at a national level, some of these spaces that were already created could be made more visible and amplified at that point. And then finally, I mean, to the point, one of the reasons as well, I think it... one of the important parts of this coalition, because it was within a government system, is that it did focus on some of the technical bureaucrats and mid-level managers who are more stable and are always there and have decision-making ability. It's not a highly political intervention, but it is a safe intervention with people in government who are there as long-term bureaucrats. And also the program didn't focus that much on individuals. So it would engage with political parties, it would engage with people of certain posts, but it tried to keep things around the different different parts of governments and the individuals who occupy it, as opposed to the individual first and the post second, because that then puts you at risk for changes in the political and election cycle. So hopefully that wasn't too long, but those are the two examples.
Thank you so much, Sumaya. I think that was actually very well put for both. And what strikes me is that both cases are quite different, but in a way, there's some key things that emerge for me, at least. And there's something about sort of the organic nature of what was trying of what people were trying to do, starting rather informally, and sort of testing and being really being very patient and very persistent. So that's really interesting. Let us turn to Shibli. Shibli, you've been patiently waiting, but we really would love to hear a little bit more about your work with the tannery section, with the tannery sector in Bangladesh, which, as I understand, has spanned decades. Could you tell us a little bit about how you use coalitions, or how you have used coalitions to influence reform in the tannery sector, and how you have adapted coalition building over time to ensure that the new relocated sector is better placed to meet social and environmental safeguards?
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I would like to thank you for allowing us to be a part of this podcast. It was really nice. Just to give you a background, which is very necessary for the tannery industry in Bangladesh. So tannery industry basically in Bangladesh is one of the oldest industries. So it started back in shaping up in a formal sector back in 1950, and it was situated in Dhaka Hazaribagh, just adjacent to the river Buriganga, one of the main rivers of that goes through Dhaka. So what happened is, as it was a informal sector initially, so while it grew, so there was need of environmental protection and this sort of thing, but the sector at that time had no central, any sort of effluent treatment plant or any solid waste management, system or anything like that. So what was happening was it was basically polluting River Buriganga, because all the liquid waste and solid waste, some of them were dumped in River Buriganga, polluting the river drastically, because it basically wiped out all the aquatic life form there in River Buriganga, and also it made the water really, really polluted. So what happened is that there is a slowly it started from different CSOs, even the government also thought of actually reducing how to reduce this environmental pollution, but they couldn't actually come up with an idea that how to do it. What the foundation basically saw that it was a mandate of the government as well. The government basically back in 2001 thought of switching the industry from Hazaribagh to someplace and some other places, areas. So they were like searching and also having this discussion with the owners and other CSOs and also other stakeholders. But the owners were very reluctant. They didn't want to move because it would cost a lot of time and also a lot of money as well. So at that point, I think back in 2012-13, the Asia Foundation started working and thought that okay, since there is this idea that this the environmental situation needs to stop, the environmental pollution needs to stop. And also, since Bangladesh has a very high raw materials, I mean raw hides, so since it's a Muslim majority country, so during the Eid al-Adha, there is a lot of cattle being slaughtered, and so we have a lot of raw hides. So there is a very good potential of export and also internal market for the leather industry. So the government has this idea that they were thinking of relocating it, but the owners were really, really, really very against it. And so there was a very tug of war, I would say, that the government was trying, but the owners were not really into it. So at that point, the Asia Foundation came in and thought that, okay, what should be done? So they thought of building a coalition of experts, like research organizations, and also the we had like several discussions with the owners. Is stating that, okay, this industry is growing basically. And right now, they were in a 50 acres area landmass. So the industry is growing. They actually require more land. So we are trying to give them some sort of a carrot, you know. So we basically had a political economy analysis done. So where the power and the resource solutions and those sort of things. So we also try to motivate them. Okay, you need more land area. And also, the environment is a big deal. If you start exporting to European or American markets, then you cannot export to those markets without having compliant industry. So we started discussing with the government, the research firms who did a very good research, and we also actually took the report to the government and also these other. And then finally, all of them sat together. They discussed it, and they actually finally the owners also agreed to move to a newer location. And the government said that, okay, there is this location in Sawar with a 200 acres of mass. So the government has like two ideas into mind, and that one is the growth of the business, and another is environmental protection, that the pollution that is happening, so to reduce that. So in the new relocated area, so there is a central effluent plant. The government actually, in coalition with China, developed a central effluent plant, and this sector was basically given under BSIC, Bangladesh Small and Cottage Industries Corporation, but the industry basically is really huge. You know, it's a 200, more than 200 industries allocated together. This is the tannery industrial estate. It is so, it's really big. For BSIC, who actually follows up with a small and cottage industries, they have no manpower, no resource, no understanding to actually run such a big infrastructure and such a big, big industry, basically. So what happened is that during this, the relocation started in 2017, quite prematurely, I would say, because the tannery industry in Sawar was not ready at that time, but they were forced to move because the government was trying to show that, okay, we are doing something good. So they actually forced the industry to move there, and it took almost like 2 years. The shift started in 2017 and it completed in 2019. So what happened is during these 2 years, the industry basically lost a lot of businesses. Because, because of orders are being cancelled, because 2 years no order will be stay there, and some because of relocation and everything, so that happened. So again, the need came that when it went there, so the industry was not ready. So there was no chrome recovery unit. There was no the central effluent treatment plant. Basically, when they developed the government, because we as the coalition, we actually made it through that, okay, the need to understand by the owners and also by the government that, okay, they all need to relocate and for a better work environment, but after that, what happened is the government took all these decisions, and when the relocation happened, the government didn't think about the workers, basically. So there was no workers facility. They have no accommodation, no health benefit, no hospitals, no education for their children, no transportation, nothing. So seeing that the Asia Foundation again thought, okay, we need more intervention there. So in 2018, the Asia Foundation again intervened in the sector and tried to bring in, tried to identify what are the, we did at that time, we actually started thinking and working politically, because we were thinking okay, so now it has, the relocation happened, but now what next step? What is there to do and what is there not to do, right? And who are the power influencers that we need to work with, because at that time the owners are basically saying that okay, we have moved in here, but look, this most of the things are not ready here. So again, we started working, and we started working with the government as well, and also with BSIC and other stakeholders, the Tanners Owner Association. We started working with the Worker Association, because since there is no support for workers, so it was a basic need for the workers to have, transportation, accommodation, and also the sector is, like I said, though it was growing, but it doesn't have those formal initiations, the workers are not always getting ID cards, agreements for their workers, and they do not have other benefits and everything, they're not there. So the foundation started working with the workers initially to actually give them training on advocacy and other issues, and also occupation health and safety issues, training on those, and advocacy, and actually how to talk to the owners about their rights and issues. But then again, we did another PEA for that there, and we also thought of how to work, so what is happening there, and we found out that so if we do not engage the owners again, then nothing will happen there. So we started bringing in the owners and also other development agencies and so on. And we thought that, we also identified that there are other organizations also working, other international organizations, local organizations working in that sector. And there is no collaboration between all these organizations. So in silos, every organization is working in silos, and they do not know what other organization is doing. So what we thought of that, we actually came out with the idea that to actually establish a leather development forum. So where we brought all these organizations into under one umbrella, the Leather Development Forum, and that is another sort of coalition that happened within that industry, and we brought in all of them, and the interest is really high right now. So we are now this coalition is basically now working with the government, talking with the government about different issues, the solid waste management, the central effluent treatment plant, and how to manage the whole industry. So there are all these discussions happening under this LDF, and also all this coalition and everything. So we are hoping for a bright future going forward. So let's hope for the best. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Shibli, for that grand tour, actually. And in fact, I'm really happy to hear about where that tannery sector coalition has got into, because I believe that now, several years ago, and I don't know if it's been more than a decade, actually, but Lisa Denny, who was at the time at ODI, was involved, I think, in one of the early TAF political economy studies. And it was one of these really sort of ambitious kinds of studies that were seeking to actually track what was happening over time. So it's really good to have that picture, and then to hear what you have said now. And really what has struck me is how nonlinear this effort has been, and how, again, perseverance and patience is really quite important. Right. And also the possibility to ensure that critical voices that may not have the power or capacity to participate somehow have a voice and can come together with others who are also important in making decisions to seek the way forward. So let's hope for a brighter future, as you say, and really great to have that overview of where that has gotten to. Nicola, perhaps by way of conclusion, obviously, as I said earlier, we're one of the lead authors of this report, and now we have heard from Shibli and from Sumaya. And I'm wondering if you take a bit of a step back and reflect both on what they have said and the other case studies that are included in the publication, what strikes you as some of the key lessons that have emerged in terms of how an international actor like TAF can support coalition building efforts in country? And how would you say these may be linked to thinking working politically? Thank you.
Thanks, Elena. So, yeah, I think in multiple ways. I think one of the things that spurred us on to do this in the first place is, and this is the you know ongoing conundrum with TWP is the what does it look like? What does it look like in practice? And our teams have this, and we have this when we engage with our teams, and we felt that this is a really great example of exactly thinking working politically in practice. It's when people are the prioritized area of work is to think about how you're engaging on a particular reform agenda or reform momentum and the different actors and how they're operating around that, and then what your role could be to bring them together, to link them and to facilitate that. And that you can see with our teams who've worked on this, that is front of mind. They're not thinking in terms of outputs and deliverables and, you know, producing a report, et cetera, et cetera. That's really what they're thinking when they're doing this. And it starts to give us these really concrete examples of TWP. I think it's also really interesting to see the ways in which otherwise technical interventions are being used politically in these examples. So it's not that the research was done for the research sake or even necessarily for the findings of the research. But in the example in Bangladesh, they did the research and convened around it. And it gave the team an opportunity to change the terms of the conversation, which up until then had led to a political stalemate in that particular sector. So the research is the mechanism to do something else. And similarly, in other examples, we see, like the Sri Lanka example, the technical solutions that the government officials are training in and doing all of these things, they are one outcome of the activity, but the other outcome is actually some of the relationships and the links that they're building and the other things going on the side. So that's where I think it starts to give us a really interesting example, not only of TWP, but also where locally led development can interact and intersect with TWP, because we are looking very much at local reform agendas, and all of the actors within, you know, most of the actors within most of the coalitions are all local actors coming together in locally identified reform agendas. So I think, in terms of the sorts of things that external partners can an international audience can get from this, there's a couple of things in at the conclusion about, you know, that, I mean, timeframes, we've been talking about timeframes for decades, but we still have to talk about timeframes because nobody seems to get any longer than a 3 to 5 year timeframe. And you do need to be thinking in longer timeframes. And so we're saying, you know, think in decades. And that donors and international partners can help creating space, because these are informal, they're often unpredictable. And so, your 12-month work plan is not going to be able to set out exactly where your coalition is going to go from A to B. It is going to be a winding road. And, I mean, Shibley's story over well over 10 years is got lots of ups and downs in it. And I think, you know, you can come in a few years ago and the team would have been tearing their hair out in terms of where the program would go. So there's that, but it's also that we still need, within the aid industry, we still need to move away from all of the things that deflect our attention from these things that are going on. Because the way all of the programs are set up, they're continually deflecting us from, you know, because we're and our teams, when we talk to them about these programs, they tell us about the deliverables, the research output, the reporting to donors and all of the outputs. And it's really hard to get beyond, you know, that to the sorts of outcomes that they're actually achieving beyond what they've promised to various donors through their programs. And so the timeframes, but also the systems that we have for collecting information on what we're doing in development, mitigate against being able to see these longer term narratives. And I think that's something that we hope to find some more resources to keep documenting some of these stories, because we think they're really useful for people to understand how we might do that a little bit differently. I hope that answers
your
question.
Brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much, Nicola. And also thank you to Shibli and Sumaya for all of the wonderful inputs you have made in this interview today. I think it has been very helpful in terms of really bringing to life what coalition building looks like in practice, as you were saying, Nicola. I am left very curious, actually, about whether and how the case studies explore how TAF as a funder was able to enable this kind of really rather different way of working that requires a completely different mindset and approach, as you were saying, not focusing on the sort of obvious programmatic sort of checkpoints, but really having a much more open and reflective way of engaging with something. So I don't know if the case studies help to answer that, but if not, maybe that's the next challenge. But thank you so much.
Yeah.
Oh, go for it.
Oh, just on that, I do think that they're really led by long-term senior local staff. I mean, Shibli's been around since early on, and Gopa Tampi, who run the program in Sri Lanka, he's been involved in that program for 15 years, and so there is sort of a senior local staff. I mean, you know, Jaime Fastino has been in Coalitions for Change for a really long time. There are staff who are just really passionate about it and stay around for a really long time, and are given a lot of free rein to shape these programs and shape these reforms in the way that they think that they should go. And then the rest of TAF sort of supports them. So I think that's a really important part of it as well.
Excellent. Well, on that note, let me thank you all again for a wonderful conversation. And good luck. And let's hope for future successes in coalition building. Thank you.